This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. America's fundamental narrative tells us that anyone can come to the States, take part in community, prosperity, and upward mobility if they believe in freedom. But the reality lived by millions of Americans of color is that that narrative is somewhat less true for Americans who don't look Caucasian or who practice religions other than Christianity. Michigan State University Assistant Professor Nazita Lajavardi has written a new book exploring the experiences of Muslim Americans. It's called Outsiders at Home, and she joins us today. Nazita, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Your book explores the experience of Muslims in America through some personal details, but primarily through data. Why did that feel important?
Yeah, I mean, it feels important because while we know a lot anecdotally about Muslims facing discrimination in the United States, you don't have to go too far back in history to remember, you know, how political elites linked them with 9/11 after those attacks, thinking through the widespread surveillance programs and prolonged detentions. There's also been a rise in anti-Muslim incidents, as well as, you know, anti-Sharia laws that are being introduced and even enacted in a lot of states. We can even think, obviously, through the 2016 election, where presidential candidates not only frequently raised them in debates and made them visible, but they also endorsed policies that would target the group and continue to isolate them. And then finally, we've had a Muslim ban, right? So we have a number of different pieces of evidence that tell us that, at least anecdotally, there's something up. But unless we can measure it, and unless we can show that this group is facing discrimination in a number of different ways that is political, that shows that there are systematic differences in the quality of representation, then we don't really have a leg to stand on, right? So these just all become anecdotes. And so I thought it was very important for us to be able to show that what we perceive as being true is in fact happening, and to show the many dimensions in which political discrimination manifests against this population.
You begin with some history and talk about the fact that for a long time, Middle Eastern immigrants to the United States, many of whom were Muslim, were often considered white for all practical legal purposes. Could you talk a little bit about that policy and when and how it ended?
Sure, yeah. So it's actually quite interesting. And I think people often forget that, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was a struggle for naturalization. And naturalization was limited to white persons, determined by the courts. And of course, naturalization was important for a number of different outcomes, such as voting, of course, first and foremost, but also for property ownership even. And so Middle Easterners also were part of this movement to gain naturalization rights. And in doing so, many of them were actually granted privileges of whiteness, especially with the 1915 Dow versus United States case. This was a case involving a Syrian man where the courts in that case granted privileges of whiteness to Syrians, Parsis, and different individuals from various nationalities. So why I bring this up in the book is because I think it's very important to contextualize that this is a group that is incredibly diverse. For instance, about half are immigrants and born abroad. About 25% are African American. And so when you think of that different diversity, these individuals were granted privileges of membership in the polity at different times, but now they're all being excluded according to their Muslim background.
Yeah. You also spend a lot of time writing about the fact that since September 11th, there has been a degree of pan-Muslim identity that has taken root both sort of within scholarly circles and in how some Muslims think about their own place in the community. Even though historically there have been plenty of reasons why, for example, Americans whose families come from different Muslim countries or who might follow different Sunni or Shi'i traditions, they might not see things the same way. For the purposes of federal law enforcement, those differences might be a moot point. Tell us about the consequences to the whole question of pan-Muslim identity for people in America.
Sure. So, you know, we often talk about pan-ethnic identities, and what we mean by that is, how does the public view you What group do they think you belong to? And so it really doesn't matter if you choose to say, I am white, or I am Middle Eastern. It's really how the public classifies you that matters. And so with Muslims, what's really fascinating is that there are individuals out there, such as Sikhs, for instance, such as Arab Christians, right, who at first glance may appear to the public as being Muslim because of the tropes that they see being communicated to them. They may not, for instance, see a Congress member like Andre Carson and label him as Muslim. How the public views Muslims actually has quite racialized them. And, you know, I'm aware that these, you know, we're talking about a religious group and I just used a word that had the word racial in there. But racialization is a process whereby groups are inherently labeled as inferior. They're collectively classified without really much control over that identity group. They're often labeled as being disloyal. And I think it's consequential because it matters for how the public treats them. It matters for how legislators treat them. It matters if, for instance, somebody perceives a candidate who's running for office as being Muslim. It matters that they're racialized, even if perhaps the candidate is not, and they just, for instance, have an Arabic-sounding name. I think it's very important to think through the consequences of racialization and this pan-ethnic identity in terms of their political treatment and positionality.
I can't tell you how sad I was when I got to the part of the book that has a chapter entitled Introducing the Muslim American Resentment Scale. Can you, again, as we said, this was part of the point of the book, was to talk about quantifying the anecdotal things that Muslims in America may experience. Can you talk about what kind of measurements the scale involves?
Sure. So the Muslim American Resentment Scale is a series of 9 different statements, stereotypical statements that ask individuals about how much they agree or disagree with the statements. For instance, most Muslim Americans integrate successfully into American culture, or Muslim Americans sometimes do not have the best interests of Americans at heart, or most Muslim Americans are not terrorists. And essentially, these 9 items, I've argued in a number of papers that they actually capture really specific stereotypes and prejudices towards Muslim Americans. What was happening before I developed the scale was that individuals were taking a set of items about African Americans and they were saying, look, this predicts policy support about Muslims. Look, this is about Muslims. And I just didn't really think that was fully capturing the specificity of the bias that existed in the mass public. And so the purpose of this scale is really to understand whether or not there are specific predictors of mass attitudes towards Muslim Americans that are shaping individuals' policy support, their candidate support, and essentially their voter behavior even.
If you're just joining us, my guest is MSU professor Nazita Lajavardi. She's the author of a new book, Outsiders at Home. It's a data-driven look at the experiences of Muslims in the U.S. When Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar were elected to Congress in 2016, it felt like an exhalation to a lot of people who had been waiting to see more representation, who were looking for a sign that a political acceptance of Muslim candidates could indeed happen. What are some of the things you've observed about the way that they've moved through mainstream politics and the way that they've used their pulpits and just sort of how the party's leadership has interacted with them?
It's interesting because now we have on the center stage 2 Muslim women, one of whom is of Arab descent, one of whom is of African descent, you know, one of whom is an immigrant, one of whom wears a hijab. And so there is this interaction between a gender identity and a religious identity and a racial identity that's happening in a way that doesn't really manifest for the male Muslim members of Congress.
Not to mention a political identity.
Right, and a political identity, exactly. And so before, when we were studying Muslim candidates, we really only could look at Keith Ellison and Andre Carson and look at, okay, do they have bias against the Muslim community? Do they advertise themselves as being Muslim? But their Muslim identities, they could choose whether or not to engage that because their names are not Muslim sounding. I'm putting that in air quotes. Mm-hmm. They don't, you know, wear, you know, religious garb. So it's less obvious to the public that these individuals may be Muslim. On the flip side, you have two women who sort of entered the political stage during the Year of the Woman, and they have taken up a lot of attention. And so if you look at the disproportionate amount of weight that's being attributed to them, especially by Republicans and especially by the president, it serves to reinforce the fact that these women are consistently being racialized. At the same time, their identities are part of what makes individuals connect to them, right? That's part of what draws their supporters to them.
You spent some time talking about the fact that the Democratic left, which at one point was sort of a natural ally for Muslim voters, has oftentimes not really lived up to voters' expectations, and that in fact there was a time not that long ago when Republicans were pretty actively courting Muslim voters in Michigan and other places. What do you think is holding back candidates in 2020, in this modern time, from making a more public pitch to Muslim voters?
So on the one hand, we don't actually know how many Muslim voters there are. And this is because the U.S. Census doesn't collect data on religion. So legislators don't even know who they need to mobilize. They don't even know how many there are to mobilize. And estimates of the population range from 2 million to 15 million. So if we don't really know how many Muslims there are in America, and we think it's pretty small of a percentage, then maybe we can ignore them. Maybe they're just a captured vote, and maybe they can be ignored in politics. If your constituents who have, you know, a lot of Muslim American resentment are aware of the fact that you're privileging Muslims, that you're recruiting Muslims, that you're campaigning to them, well, then you might face a backlash, and you're not quite sure how many Muslims are going to get out to vote for you anyways.
So at the same time, you point out that Muslims represent a significant population in many of the swing states, including Michigan.
Right. Yeah, it's phenomenal because it's a calculus. And it actually, in one of the studies in my book, I find that Democrats sort of throughout the country, they discriminate against Muslims. But in the states where there's a large Muslim population, there's actually a little bit of hope. Both Republicans and Democrats do a little bit to try to recruit them. So there is a positive spin.
Muslim Americans are not politically homogenous. How do you interpret some of the ways that they've reacted to the heightened visibility that they experience in day-to-day life and how that's reflected in their politics?
Yeah, they're absolutely not uniform. I think when asked at the current time, most Muslims would report voting for a Democratic candidate just because they've been so ostracized by the Republican Party. But if you just go back to 2000, to the year 2000, that was a time where Muslims actually tried to mobilize behind George Bush. If you just look at what happened in just 20 years, it's pretty phenomenal to see how they were pushed away from one party to another. They're a group that at the moment, I think they're, if they do vote, if they do participate, they're going to be solidly behind the Democratic Party. And that's simply because of they have nowhere else to go. But in terms of how conservative their values are, there's certainly room for Republicans to try to create a policy agenda that would appeal to them.
What did you learn through all of the statistical work that you did in the book? Do you feel like you learned anything about what it would take to help reduce the resentment, as the index puts it, toward Muslims?
Yeah, so I'd like to point out that I think media coverage matters a lot. And what we see sort of happening over time is that the media is talking about Muslims kind of generally and African Americans and Latinos at very, very high rates in its coverage. And I'm talking mostly about CNN, Fox, and MSNBC. These three cable news outlets are featuring these groups at very, very high rates. And on top of that, when they are featured, Muslims come out on bottom and they're not doing so well. What's been really encouraging is that I find that at different time periods, positive coverage can actually reduce resentment. And that gives me a lot of hope that if we are able to create news content that is more positive and is not sort of overstating the negative attributes about stigmatized groups, then we might actually see some changes in the mass public's opinions and perhaps treatments of one another.
You know, I wondered about your own experience with this. Your folks came to the United States from Iran, and I wondered what you had observed of their own sense of themselves as Americans and just sort of what your own experience had been with this over the years.
Yeah, so, you know, I was raised in a somewhat religious Muslim family, and my parents immigrated here in the 70s as students before the revolution, and they were excluded from their home country because once the revolution happened, they couldn't return. They were still continuing their studies. And so I was sort of raised with sort of understanding, you know, what hard work was, but I never really understood what exclusion felt like until 9/11. My parents became so frightened after the United States invaded Iraq, after they had already invaded Afghanistan, because Iran is situated specifically in the middle of those two countries, and they felt that, okay, Iran is next, and they've just been labeled the axis of evil, and so what does that mean? And so they actually went out and they purchased a home abroad in a different country, thinking, you know, we don't want to be members of a polity where they're going to go and, you know, bomb our home country. And so for a long time, they held on to that property, and they really worked to make it home because they were so scared. And I think that was the first time I really understood, you know, what citizenship meant to them. It wasn't, they didn't feel American. And so I began to doubt if I was American. And it really manifested for me after the 2016 presidential campaign when the Muslim ban was enacted. I was devastated. I never thought this would ever happen. And my mom sort of turned to me and said, well, what did you expect? You know, when we became citizens, they made us sign a paper that said, you know, that we are aware that our citizenship could be revoked. And I had no idea that that was even possible. And I'm a lawyer. It was sort of shocking to me. It was a rather strong critique of her membership in the American polity and of what it meant to her to be an American. She always felt like her identity was being held hostage. And so I think over the time, their experiences, as well as my own experiences, have made me question, you know, how do I feel American? What makes me feel American? And I believe in the Constitution, not in, of course, the realities that have happened in the United States and its history, but the words on the page. I think they've given and they've breathed life to a form of democracy that's imperfect, of course, and is exclusionary, of course, but it still worked to further things. And so I think that's kind of what makes me still feel American and hold on to that identity.
Nisita Lajavardi's new book is called Outsiders at Home. It's an examination of the experiences of Muslims in America. She's an assistant professor at Michigan State University. Nisita, thank you for the book and for your time today.
Thank you so much.